So the talk next week will be on what I'm doing really I'm more doing evolution of proteases, molecular biology of trypanosomatids, but I was drawn into Tara project because I just loved it and the whole concept of it. And so the title is formal a little bit now, but we can really make it informal. I will try to tell you more about the whole philosophy of Tara. And the point of the talk is actually, the title is here, diplonemids. So these are, this is a typical case, and I think that's one of the really nice outcomes of the Tara project. So talking about biodiversity, people imagine, of course, these really colorful places with a lot of animals and trees and beetles, of course, because God must have loved beetles. There are so many species, but there are also protists, protist diversity. And protist diversity until recently was pretty much, you looked under the microscope, you saw a protist, it had a flagellum, it did not, it was big, small, but there was not that much. Electron microscopy, of course, opened more, but in the end, it was only sequencing, environmental sequencing, that is showing us how many protists are there. And so the Tara project cared about the biodiversity in the ocean. And this is just, again, a visually attractive, but we thought about different biodiversity there. This is a general tree of eukaryotic diversity, and the point I want to make...
Can you say one sentence about how
it's
got organized?
Yeah, it will come in a second. Just five slides about protists and then Tara more. So this slide just shows that in the eukaryotic diversity on this planet, most branches are protozoan. Okay, protists occupy most of the eukaryotic tree.
So what's the definition of a protist?
Single cellular organism.
Single cellular eukaryotes,
right. And so here is some people take them there, some not, usually protistologists don't work with fungi, but they would fit there, yeah. So here is just a study that we did based on environmental sequencing, and you have these 2 million catalog species, and protists just make this small fragment, I mean, the described species. But if you take environmental sequences, protists will occupy 70% of all the diversity that is indicated by them. And of course, protists are extremely variable in terms of morphology. I mean, they can be pretty bizarre. These guys are like some kind
of... Can I just ask, for those of us that only live in the bacterial world, so 3% in for eukaryotes. So if you look at metazoan groupings, how far away is 3%?
You mean 3%?
Like across all vertebrates, or what's, how much 18S difference is?
So if you take the 18S variability in sequences in 18S,
yeah.
Well, 3% is the kind of accepted difference between species, also in protists.
But what about mammals? And 3% is better.
Mammals are on a different scale.
Right.
I work with Trypanosoma brucei, but Trypanosoma cruzi
yeah.
is so different.
Yeah.
It's still one genus
yeah.
because they are morphologically similar,
right.
but they are like an elephant from a zebra at least. Yeah, in terms of distance, genetic distance. So to kind of put into perspective the diversity of protists with the known diversity as how we perceive is different, it's complex.
I'm sorry, I can't say, what is that thing in the middle that looks like a spider? Is that the unicellular organism?
Yeah, that's also a unicellular.
What is it?
I will try to remember.
That's when I have no idea. What
I will look it up for you. Yeah, I will actually. I may remember it.
Go back, Julius. Go back one. There was that one more.
That one
in the upper right. You must have made that one up.
This one? No, that's a gregarine.
Dancing
is it?
Man.
That's a Gregorian.
For any of these, is knowing the name useful?
They are useful to themselves.
No,
is the name.
No, this is a Gregorian. These are diatoms.
So, if you know about them, they are right. I mean, is a proteobacteria useful to you, or firmicutes useful if you know the classification? But
this is not
the name. So the point of this quick was just to show you how protists are diverse in morphology. They are extremely diverse in, for example, organelles that they carry. And they are diverse in the size of their genomes. So the smallest genome is eukaryotic genome so far is encephalitozoon, which is here. But these are also protists. Yeah, these are amoebas. So there are amoebas, there are dinoflagellates that can have 100 times bigger genomes than human. Human is this one. So the span of gene size in protists is enormous. And so this is where Tara comes in. The whole concept was kind of thought through by Eric Carcenti, who is a retiring, he's retiring for quite some time now, from EMBL, and a cell biologist who thought, well, I'm an old man, I'm retiring, I still want to do something substantial. And I will organize, and this, he got into touch with this guy, Etienne Bourgois, who is a wealthy philanthrop, French, and who bought this schooner from, it was an auction because the previous owner, Sir Blake, was killed on the boat by pirates. And so the boat was out there. It was specially designed for this type of expeditions, and they got very excited about it, and excited also many other people and funding bodies, like EMBL, the Prince of Monaco, gave a lot of money in this, Kaust. Many others, French, and it's very French-based, okay? So when you were on the boat, they always wrote the language is English, the common language, it was not at all. Everything was in French, even when we had this escape from the boat, or it was also in French. I did not know what to do. I speak some French now, but I speak some French, but they spoke this Breton French, which was difficult. But they were very nice guys. So this is the expeditions. Actually, the first expedition of Tara was a bizarre one, when they wanted to replicate the freezing of the boat and where it will drift, okay? And so this was done in 1890s by a Norwegian expedition. I cannot remember now the famous guy who did it, but for 3 years they froze. And they went through
Shackleton.
Shackleton was British, and this was on the south.
Not frozen in ice, yeah. Frozen with no motor, just drifting.
Drifting, yeah.
Oh, okay, that's
crazy. So they did it. They did it. They really went there. Nobody did it for 100 years. They had the boat frozen. It went up, of course, because the hull is so made so that it's not squeezed by the ice, but it gets above the ice. It turned a little bit or tilted, and they were on that for 600 days in either total darkness or total light, and they were measuring and doing funny things, and it got a lot of popularity to Tara. So they claim now their public outreach is about 20 to 25% French. When you say Tara, know exactly what it is. So it's really a major impact. And so then the major TARA expedition so far was 2009 and 2012, and the data I will be talking about briefly is from that expedition. And then I participated on another expedition that was in 2013, from May till December, and it was circumnavigating the Northern Pole. Only the second boat that ever did it. The beauty of it is that the timing was perfect. Now the Russians would never allow it. So there was special permission by Medvedev. So we had this paper with a big seal. On the seal it was written seal number one. It was provided by the Prime Minister because the TARA had to go in the northern parts of Siberia through places that are closed for military purposes, and it made it. And the collected stuff is not yet analyzed because there was a backlog, and this was published only, this expedition first, actually set of six papers were published in Science in May, this May. And that's kind of, I hope, still at the beginning. So here is how TARA looks like in the back. So you have the Rosetta here, it's really packed with equipment, which most of it I did not understand. It was oceanographers and it was monitoring everything. I was more working in this space, so there was liquid nitrogen there, so you could fix in all possible combinations your stuff, and just as apparently the oceanographers do, everything we were filtering all the time, just staying somewhere and filtering. This is a replication of former studies when people were filtering and sequencing whatever they could find. And so TARA did this. It did it probably better because of the global scale they traveled. They from the different depths, different sizes, so it was on a magnitude that was probably not done before, but by saucer and boats like this. But there is one ambition now, to tie the sequences with the organisms, actually. And so out of those billion, or at least in the ribosomal RNAs, the eukaryotic ribosomal 18S, it's like 800 million sequences. And you have, most of them do not fit with known organisms. So the idea is now to look on the samples from which we have the sequences in an automatic way and stain the cells and take pictures and sort them out and look for what actually is behind the sequences.
Could you say a little bit more about like the sampling? And so like you like, yeah, just like give a sense of how that's done.
So it's done, well, this, sorry. This was, you have either nets that are dragged behind the boat, but that's for bigger stuff. And for this, and when you go deep, you take this piece of equipment, and I'm a parasitologist, not an oceanographer, so I was learning all that. But this will go down into the ocean, and at certain depths, it will open the funnels. They will take water at exactly the same a given depth as you program it. Then you take it out. You take the water out and you filter through different size of filters. Okay, so the virologists have their filters, protistologists there. Then the rest was given to another person. So everybody got a certain amount of water, and you filter the.
And the sequencing is done from individual organisms, or is done.
No, so the sequencing. No, then the sequences. Of course, you from whatever you filtered, you isolate DNA, and that is sequenced all of it. I mean, if you
is that a shotgun based or is it 18S primer based?
It was 18S primer based. It was just even part of, as I will show, part of 18S.
Is there any shotgun militarily so you can assess how broad? I mean, because as you know, you have introduced biases with your
absolutely
18S primers.
Yeah. But no, not yet. Not yet. So the whole estimation of what is out there is now based on the 18S ribosomal RNAs. But you introduce bias. You may have more of certain 18S because it's amplified more efficiently. There are more copies of 18S in a given cell. So you have to really correlate it with morphology, and that hasn't been done yet.
So Shelley, so for example, for a lot of human microbiome studies, I mean, the primers dramatically, those that are not shotgun-based, dramatically exclude eukaryotic sequences or are limited to fungal sequences. So there's a gross undersampling of eukaryotic sequences in human microbiome analysis.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's
the question, this is the future. We have a large number of ribosomes per cell. You can't do things where you reverse transcribe from the ribosomal RNA.
At this stage, we cared about the diversity of them. So even if you have many copies of certain 18S, I mean, diatom can have 1,000 copies, while another protist can have only 10 per cell, but they are homogenized. They always have the same sequence.
Right.
Okay, so if you care about the diversity of them, you are not bothered by that. If you would care about...
If you want to associate with single cells...
Then it matters.
Yeah.
Yeah, then it will matter, of course. So here is the expedition. So they took off from France, went through here, of course, most of the really nice places, and then returned. They even were visiting in New York, and Pan Ki Moon was on the boat, and so they really know how to do these things. And the other trip on which I participated went from here through here, and then they came up through here. They froze the boat. I have, if we have time, a few slides from that. They froze down. The beauty is that in Canada there is a rule: if you freeze, the icebreaker will release you for free. So they just sent icebreaker, and then they got a passage, and they winded through the islands here, and I joined them in northern Greenland and went to Quebec and then back to France. So here is some.
Right.
Yes.
So some of those were fluorescence images. So the samples were collected. Some part of that was used for sequencing. Some part of that was used for EM, and some part of that was imaged.
Right.
On the ship.
No. So we had a microscope, a nice one, which I was trying to use, but then we had a major wave that destroyed it totally. Even if it was attached and everything was attached.
So things were fixed for like...
So if things are fixed and things... So actually at this stage, the 18S sequencing was done and various other things, but the morphology, so they now set up at Heidelberg, at EMBL, and I haven't seen it, how it works, a confocal microscope that should automatically take pictures of cells that have been stained with formalin pretty much or osmium, and in parallel scanning electron microscopy is being done, not transmission, because transmission is going nowhere. You have pellets and you don't know what is there.
But does the fluorescence we're looking at was with a specific immunofluorescence, or is that chlorophyll autofluorescence?
So there will be DAPI staining. There will be staining with some general working antibodies, so that you can estimate. There will be, of course, just Nomarski or light pictures, and millions of them.
Associated sequence with morphology.
Yes.
You need to do some
Of course, so the question is, as long as we will have a guess what is what, then we can do fish experiments, okay? So for example, if we know that we have a lot of I will be talking about the group that I am responsible for, diplonemids. So if we have their sequences everywhere, but in some samples, at some depths, at some filters, they are enriched. So once we will have pictures from that particular fraction, light microscopy, and we will see some cells, okay, then we will try to do...
But for your RNA, you ought to be able, I mean, you have, if they collected enough samples of these and they're enriched, you ought to be able to do single cell PCR on this for 18S to figure out what's...
It's not that simple. I don't think we will be able to do, if we go out, we were doing single cell genomics now in Curaçao with Patrick, who can do it. You really have to, it's tough. It sounds very simple in the manuscripts, but you really have to have a microscope, you have to have live cells, you have to track them down, pick one single cell from the fixed samples. I don't believe it will ever work. No. Single cell genomics, that we will not extract out.
I guess it's not genomics you're trying to do. You're just trying to associate an 18S sequence. Mm-hmm. And as you're pointing out, for these Gregorines or diplomorans or whatever, you're going to have thousands of ribosomes there. You know exactly what the whatever it is. I don't know.
Maybe if only, I would say. So here is the...
People have done, people have been doing off of blood smears from Plasmodium infected red cells.
They did, yes.
Do in situ...
Even sphinx.
Single cell speciation on an air-dried blood smear.
Yeah, 50 years old. In principle, it should be possible. So this is the... 18S or SSU, and the fragment actually that was used is V9. So it's a short fragment, 128 bases, actually very short. But you have to start from somewhere. The number of sequences is so far of this was about 800 million, and the projection now is that we are really kind of getting to saturation in terms of sequences, so even more sequencing would not change much of that. And it's actually by the first data we are getting from the other expedition is supporting this view. So more sequencing would not really help. I forgot to say that there is now an expedition being prepared, and that's called Tara Coral Sea. So they are going to explore the corals and the reefs, how they look like. So that's from the from one of the papers that appeared in May in Science, and that's the V9 diversity. And just that, when you sorted out all the sequences into different groups as they are known, here you had typing units, and here you had the number of reads. So it more or less, to some extent, it fit what you would expect. So diatoms would be there, dinoflagellates would be extremely abundant, some other groups. But there was one group that made me really happy, which is shown here, which had a substantial fraction of the sequencing, and it's called diplonemids. Okay, so that was what are diplonemids? Even expert protistologists usually don't know them. In textbooks, they have half page or something. They are a sister group of my favorites, kinetoplastids, and then euglenids, of course. Kinetoplastids were rare there because you would have to have a fish with trypanosomes in the blood or extremely rare. Euglenids were surprisingly rare there too. They are more freshwater. But this group popped up. And we know there are three species that have been described so far. So we know close to nothing about
it. So what's the scale here? Is it
These are, okay, there is no scale here. So these are about 20 micrometers long cells. So a substantial size for protists. So here is, again, the map. And here are two stations that are in which diplonemids represented 71% or 51% of total barcodes, all of them. So half of what in that depth, okay, so deep and cold.
So that was the photonic layer that you were talking about.
No. So actually, that's another complication. All the papers in science care about the photic layer. Okay. Now we are preparing a paper that will focus on this group, regardless of from where it is. And the diplonemids actually appeared in all stations, in all fractions. That makes them...
So at all depths?
At all depths, yeah. We have now from Russia some samples that are from 6,000 meters, and diplonemids are there. Okay, so either it's a mirage, I almost start to worry.
Are they photosynthetic?
So that's at the end of the talk, no idea. We only know they are not photosynthetic, because if you have them 6,000 meters deep, they will not get any light there. Whether they are parasitic, free-living, predatory, we have no clue. Yeah? Nobody knows how these species look like. And this will be very brief because it should be informal and not really presenting my data. But we have like 30,000 species of diplonemids now. And so that qualifies them as the third most diverse eukaryotes in the ocean. And we have morphology about one, which was isolated by a Japanese guy into culture. He just got a grant from Moore Foundation to turn them into genetically tractable systems, to try to electroporate DNA into them and just to start working on them. Because in the protist community, you have this funny situation. People study organisms that are either protists, that are either parasitic historically, or those that you can cultivate and do something about it. But they may not be really ecologically relevant. So this is a case where we really don't know anything about this group, not even how they look like, but they are everywhere in the ocean.
So it's just for comparison, what's the comparison in species diversity and say biomass between eukaryotes, prokaryotes, and phage?
Oh, biomass, I don't know.
Or species diversity?
I would be afraid that this will vary extremely, but I cannot answer that question. It will vary extremely. This is just a slide showing that people saw these diplonemids, of course, before a little bit. That in the gene bank we found 156 diplonemid sequences before we uploaded our millions, and this is just. Just came out in Current Biology. So this actually shows how crazy it is. So if you take all the sequences, eukaryotic sequences from Tara, you have metazoans there, you have rhizarians, you have dinoflagellates, and MALF, which is alveolates, a group of alveolates, pretty much the same situation. Nobody knows what they do, how they look like. And diplonemids, okay? So out of the total number of sequences, diplonemids make not so big fraction. I mean, they are cool, but they will not change everything. But if you take the diversity of the sequences, then diplonemids, which we don't know how they look like, they out of this pizza pie of eukaryotic diversity, global eukaryotic diversity in the ocean, they make substantial 15-20%. So they are like extraterrestrials. Here is a distribution of the sampling. Okay, so of course, we do not have from every station, we do not have all depths and all filters, because it was, for example, impossible to do it under the circumstances. When I was on Tara in Labrador Sea in November, I really had to take a lot of these pills and everything, because otherwise you could not do much. But in the end, we have, this is the photic layer, and the deeper fractions, deep chlorophyll maximum, and so on. Now I will not bother you with the data. It's complicated to describe. The whole point of the few slides here is that now we are preparing a paper where we really dissect the diplonemids. So first of all, what we did was, if you have such a diversity as is shown here, and nobody knows how they look like, you really start worry. Okay, you think maybe this is, maybe their diversity of their sequences within the cell is, there is some, they may differ. Even if it's ribosomal RNA, who knows? So we went to Canadian group that sequenced the Diplonema papillatum, and we showed that all ribosomal RNAs within that cell are completely the same. So no change of paradigm there. So we know that whatever differences we found, and these thousands and thousands of sequences that differ in 3% of sequence, the typing units, and now you have the concept of swarms. Okay, so the just very briefly, in the, you have the sequences that will diverge. Okay, you can build trees, but then with this number of sequences, you have point differences. So the swarms actually look like this, pretty much. So you have point differences, and this is defined as a swarm. Okay, a group of sequences that apparently is likely to be one species, but there are sequencing mistakes, and there are maybe one base differences. And so here,
this is all based on that.
On that small fragment.
So,
yeah.
So the thought is that this is all still one species and not maybe allelic polymorphisms, but.
Right. Yeah. And so now we are looking on this data set from different perspectives. Okay. Are the diplonemid sequences that we have from the photic zone similar or totally different from those that are deeper? Are those from the size fraction of above 20 micrometers different from those that we have in the size fraction 1 to 5 micrometers, and so on? So you can really play a lot with these. This is just a vertical structuring, a relatively simple slide. So are the diplonemids from the ocean depths different from those on the surface? Yes, they are. Yeah, so you have this. This is the deep samples, mesopelagic surface. So you see on the surface you have 875 typing units, which overlap with the deeper fractions only with this number of typing units. You can stratify it. You can really look from the size. The abundance, you can analyze the abundance. Are there typing units that are globally distributed? Are there endemics, and so on? So this is how we approached it. Are there overlaps in the swarm between different provinces? Where is most of the diversity of these organisms? It seems it's southern.
The provinces.
So the
geographically
it's okay. Here. Okay, sorry. So it's in color here. So you will have southern
different
Pacific.
Yeah.
Just that's how the oceanographers actually define their regions. I know very little about it. Beta diversity, what's where. In the end, This is the contribution that is now. So we from the Tara data, the problem with Tara is a little bit that I mean, it was organized perfectly. There was so much wine on the boat. It was French, really. You formally had to request the key from the wines from the captain, but he would always give it. And so that was beautiful about the French. Less is now how to get the data from them, who is responsible for who is not on holidays, and things like that. So when I was on Tara, I actually was already worried about these things. So I wanted to filter something for myself. And they said, no, impossible. I mean, this is all Genoscope. All the sequences from the samples should be analyzed by Genoscope. But thanks to Garcenti, who was on board, he said, OK, Julius, whatever. But this is exception. That enabled us to isolate DNA by ourselves and sequence the whole ribosomal RNAs and compare whether this is real. This is the whole tree of the diplonemids, okay, from the global picture. But this is only what I collected. The red ones are from several stations that from the Labrador Sea, and these are already full ribosomal RNAs. So this is pretty solid now. And you see they are, so in that cold place, somewhere in the middle of Labrador Sea, you have diplonemids that pretty much fell throughout the diversity. So, okay, ocean is mixing everything up, but that we will find out of 104 full-size clones, 85 unique species. Shows that in that particular place, pretty much every diplonemid cell is different from the other one.
Have you done any sequencing of protein coding regions to see if those ratios of protein differences?
Not yet. Yeah.
For scale, are those outgroups there kinetoplastid, or is that all eukaryotic?
These are kinetoplastids here. What are they doing there? Not phototrophs, apparently.
Even the ones that are on the photic plate?
No, because from what we know from the related groups, diplonemids are more closely related to kinetoplastids. Euglenids are photosynthetic, but they have secondary plastid that they acquired after they branched off from these two groups. So. In the only sequence diplonemid genome, and we are sequencing another one, there is no trace of a plastid. So we pretty much rule that out. So they can be anything of this. And the other paper in that Tara issue of Science was comparing actually co-occurrence. Okay, so you can extract some information if you have these millions and millions of billions, actually, or not billions, millions, but hundreds of millions sequences. You can see what occurs with what. And then it can be a parasite of that, or it can be a commensal or something like that. In terms of diplonemids that did not help at all, they are mislabeled here like as kinetoplastids. But they have connection with multicellulars, with photosynthetic, non-photosynthetic, single cellular. Did not tell, that paper did not help.
But is it thought some are pelagic and just drifting around on their own, or they all seem to be as
the, actually, the most stunning thing is how diverse they are. If they were, at least that's what people tell me, I don't know, if they were free living, they would not be so diverse. So we assume they are parasitic, many of them, but since they are so abundant, they would have to parasite themselves also. We don't know. I did some work on diplonemids 10 years ago when nobody cared. That particular species is a kind of commensal, parasitic, but you can grow it in the medium without anything. So they may be extremely flexible in their lifestyle. They may parasitize when they can. They may just feed or collect whatever they can. We have to look into the metabolism, for example, yeah? And that's what we are doing now also.
So
So did you try to culture them?
Yes, yes. Oh, not from these samples. I was reviewing a paper on a diplonemid from a Japanese guy who isolated one marine diplonemid, and I said, wow, this is, it was a small paper. This is so important. So he sent it to us. It was grown with diatoms, and so it was actually crawling into the cells of diatoms in the culture, but now it was axenized. So we can grow it without the diatoms, which enables us to do a lot. And actually, we started electroporating and using the constructs that we are using with related kinetoplastids and so on. We will see how far we go with that. So this is the conclusions, for this particular group, and I did not venture into the rest, but it shows how important it is to do this type of studies and how much, actually, from the TARA in general for eukaryotes, about 1 to 2% of sequences were identical with what we know. About 10, 15, 20% were very good predictions what they are, and then you had a scale. But for a substantial part, maybe half, you had no idea with what to attach those sequences.
So do you have a sense of how similar they look optically? So they
Not really. Until we will correlate, until we will start correlating the thousands of pictures taken from the confocal microscopy. We are doing electron microscopy, but with electron microscopy, with scanning electron microscopy, the problem is that many cells will be in a miserable shape, losing their shape, ruptured, bursted. We also have very little cells in the end. With electron microscopy, you lose a lot throughout the protocol. So we are waiting for light microscopy, any light microscopy of the same samples, and then the correlation will start. Okay, so for example, in those stations where we know that 50% of all the sequences were diplonemids, we want to see the light microscopy from that. And then we may see how they look like. Patrick Keeling actually, in light of this, went to his guys went from Vancouver into the ocean and were just collecting and sequencing single cells. Okay, they were getting single cells, and they have 5 single cells that were diplonemids. Of course, in the process they kill the cell, but it's there. So that's also a way how to get by single cell. They were taking pictures of them.
So presumably surface waters.
Surface waters. Yeah.
So if I go tomorrow to nearby sea with a bucket of water and a 20 micrometer mesh, am I going to find diplonemids?
I believe yes.
And would you be able to recognize them under a decent microscope?
I look at them for 10 years, so I should.
I make a challenge here. I think that the owners of this program probably really like to have something called Cavli or something. I told you we're going to be sampling local diversity Friday or Monday. I'd really like to get you on board so that you can try to find a diplonemid that would be associated with this course.
I may disappoint you. We already tried this in Curaçao. So there was an expedition of the Canadian Institute for Advanced Research, of which I'm part also. And so we were doing this. And we did not see them. We did not see them. Okay, we don't have the sequences yet.
The thing here is that we have all the ATS RNA.
I would love to call it Diplonema cavlii or something like that.
No problem. And we have microscopes. Yes. So first steps can be done.
Well, they are in all size fractions. So you have the smallest size fraction is until 0.8 micrometers. There is a little bit of them. Those may be degraded cells or whatever. 0.8 till 5, 5 till 20, 20 to 200, and 200 above. Okay, so those were the size fractions that were distinguished by TARA.
But some of those presumably because they're associated with another. Yeah, exactly. The
big sizes. So they are most of the time they are in the size where you expect them. I mean, so either between 5 to 20 or 20 and 200.
Okay.
That's the bulk of the sequences you get. So they are there. We don't know how we will name them. I mean, if you have 30,000 species, the idea was to take a phone list and name it after the people in the phone list, or something that would make many people happy.
Well, you can crowdsource the looking at them under the microscope, and then you can name them after the people who
know. That's true. I think crowdsourcing.
Say it again.
No, if you crowdsource the high school students to look at them under the microscope,
right?
Then you just name them for whoever.
Yeah, or for the donation of $1 or something like that. Yeah, I can imagine doing that.
Propose names, and you can crowdsource the. It's a great idea.
And for the rest, yeah, well, we can discuss, but these are a few pictures of the...
You can't fool me, those aren't Diplony.
So this is, the Tara had a camera on top of it, so you you go next to the icebergs. Here is when there were problems, a little bit too much of ice, so you really stay on the... in the and you navigate the captain. These pictures are mostly not mine, they are too nice. But that's from the northern trip. This one is a good one, yeah? So the iceberg came and took, and this is, hold on. This is how it goes when the ocean freezes. So there are some kind of
nuclear
sensors. So the captain was still trying to kind of not get frozen, okay? circling and so on. Did not work in the end. There's a few slides from
how
there.
How long did it take for the icebreaker to get there?
Yeah. the icebreaks are incredible. So when we got close to them and were taking pictures, did not want to move, the captain was restless. And he said, do you see that crack? If that falls, we are all dead. So he wanted always to get away from these. They have, so there was a camera guy, a journalist, always on the board of the ship. And he was taking pictures and he was making video every day, which had a good follow-up of somewhere between 2,000 to 20,000 people daily. And it was costly to send it to France because there was just one satellite. And so we were, so emails, we could send emails, but never attachments. Only we had to go to the captain and he would give you 5 bottles of wine, but not attachments. And for some reason. But the videos was always sent. So my family followed, of course, and the captain, this one, and I had another one. The whole routine was that scientists were there for 1 month only, and the crew was there for 3 months. So when this trip lasted from the beginning of May till December, so you had several changes of the crew, and you had many changes of scientists. So actually, it's about 250 scientists who circulated on Tara now from a number of countries. The crew was 6 guys and 6 scientists, and the crew also involved 1 journalist. So it was so nicely worked out, everything. So yeah, these are just, I think, some pictures were corrupt, but this is the last one. And this is when Tara, actually, they had a priest who christened it. And when Tara was coming back, it was in the news. I'm not French, so I cannot say how, but it's a favorite. The French like it for good reasons. And that I did not know. The French own, after the US, 2nd biggest chunks of the ocean. So that's why they got funding for it, and the funding is huge. I mean, it's in millions of euro. So the argument they are using is they own, I mean, the French territories cover in terms of ocean space, 2nd only after the US. So they keep islands here and there, and you have those 200 miles around it, and it adds up. So for Czech Republic, I'm from Czech Republic, we own not a single square meter of an ocean. Okay, so thanks for your attention. That's pretty much it.